Welcome to VCR, a vintage cinema rewind, bringing old movies to new viewers. I'm Blake.
You stupid bunnies, you got no mates.
Big water.
Yeah, wow. I was kind of like, I've never understood so little of what a character was saying, but loved him so dearly nonetheless.
Kahar is, without a doubt, my favorite character of Watership Down, and it's not even close.
It's not even close. He, like, and he comes through, right? Spoilers, I guess, but he comes through at the end. He's actually useful.
Yeah. So we're talking Watership Down, the 1978 animated film that is based on a literary classic novel. I don't think either of us have actually read the novel before.
That is untrue.
You have?
Well, 10, 11 years ago when I was in first year university, I picked up a copy. Mm-hmm. The book is split into 5 sections, and I only got through the first section before getting distracted. So you
never finished it?
No, I never did. But I got to... So the first section encompassed the first half hour of the movie. I kind of knew what was going on, and then I was kind of lost. But I mean, this book and this movie have such a strong pedigree that I kind of knew what it was about, and I kind of knew where it was going.
That's interesting. So this is our spoiler-free conversation of Watership Down, where we're talking about the characters, basic plot summary, all that sort of thing. So kind of recommending this to you if this might be of something of interest to you. We'll kind of explain all that stuff and then get into the spoiler-full discussion in our part 2 episode.
Boy, oh boy, are we going to have a hard time unpacking who this movie is for, but...
I very much agree with you on that. I think that's going to be the most interesting part of this conversation on this episode.
Yeah, no kidding. Like I was saying, the book itself kind of has a pedigree. The whole reason I picked it up 11 years ago is because I, at the time and still now, I was very interested in writing fantasy, and I knew that Watership Down was kind of like a classic work of children's fantasy, like The Hobbit, essentially.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's literally to the same pedigree as The Hobbit.
Essentially.
Or even like a half step down, potentially.
Yeah, right? Like this is a fantasy novel. This is a fantasy movie. It's got rabbits and there's no overt magic, but this is a fantasy story. Fantasy oftentimes gets
sold. It's epic.
Yeah. Like, fantasy often lives and dies on its world building. And, like, especially in the book, you see that there's a very detailed, very well thought out culture and mythology around these silly little rabbits.
Yeah. And that's something that's really interesting about the story is how much depth there is to and how much thought went into the writing of this world that we kind of just dropped right into.
Yeah, we're just seeing at a glance, right? So
yeah.
And at the same time, whereas this book kind of has its own pedigree, the movie adaptation that we're talking about this week is sort of infamous.
In a sense, very much so, yes.
Right. So I've known about this movie for years. This is my first time seeing it for the podcast. But basically, this movie kind of has a reputation for traumatizing an entire generation of British children. And probably
more, and Canadian children.
It's probably
sure
just
well.
Keeps on traumatizing new generations. Yeah, this is one of the darkest animated children's movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, and it's also infamously considered to be that as well. Like, there's maybe Fern Gully, and I can't even remember the other movie that this one often gets compared to. Last Nymph or something like that. Or The Secret of the Nymph.
The Secret of Nymph, yeah. I was going to say the early Don Bluth movies. Secret of Nymph, The Land Before Time, An Adventure Tale.
It's not quite an animated film, but... The Dark Crystal would also probably be adjacent to this, right? It's the dark take on Muppets.
Yeah, Dark Crystal for sure. Maybe Labyrinth, like the 80s right. movie with David Bowie and his giant bulge. Anyways. Yeah, I was really excited to do this one because for years, kind of going back, when I had my quarter life crisis early when I was 20, I kind of spent some time re-watching a lot of the old children's movies I saw around that time. again, I was a melancholy 20-year-old, and even back then I longed for simpler times. But in rewatching a lot of those movies, I was charmed by how bleak and dark some of them were, especially like the old-ass Don Bluth movies in the 80s. So I have always wanted to do a really, really dark children's story.
Cool.
So I was just watching this movie, just copiously taking notes the entire time. Basically, what I'm saying is that I've always wanted to traumatize a generation.
There's something powerful in that.
Yeah. I will rule them. If I can't be loved, I will be feared.
Okay. Let's get into the spoiler-free plot summary and move into there.
So, we, like Blake said, we are dropped immediately into the world of the rabbits. And these rabbits all kind of cluster around these warrens, which are like small communities. And we meet a pair of brothers, Hazel and Fiver. And Fiver is kind of unique in that he has these like almost seizures and has these very ominous visions. So
he basically has The Shining.
He basically has The Shining, yeah. So anyways, one day Hazel and Fiver are out grazing, and Fiver has a very disturbing, very vivid vision of the fields running red with blood. So Hazel...
And just to stop on that note for a sec, for the children's story here, as a quick note, we do in the first 5 minutes have a vision of a field running red with blood. Yes, you heard that correctly from Michael.
Yeah.
That's imagine not a hyperbole.
No. Like, imagine if, like, you know, the elevator doors in The Shining opening with the blood running out? Imagine if that was in the first 5 minutes. Yeah, it's funny. Fiverr's freaking out, and he's like, the hills are running red with blood, and I was just sitting there like, they certainly are. So, anyways, Fiver and Hazel decide to go see the chief of their warren to warn him of these ominous visions. Naturally, the chief kind of blows them off. But undeterred by this, Hazel and Fiver, as well as a cluster of some other rabbits, decide to flee the warren. You know, keep in mind, these are rabbits, right? And like, rabbits are prey animals. Like, think about how dangerous your life would be if you were at the bottom of the food chain and you kind of understand their predicament. So basically, what I really like about this story is that there's one, it's pretty simple, right? The rabbits flee their home. They need to find somewhere safe. They need a new home. Like, it's as simple as it gets, right? Like, you know, like the whole hierarchy of needs triangle, like shelter, I think, is the bottom one. We all need that. But as well, there's also quite a mythic and epic pretext for this story, right? Like, there's quite a lot of almost kind of references to like classical mythology. Like, the book in and of itself has been compared to Virgil's The Aeneid by many, many, many people. And again, if you don't know, that's basically the epic poem about the last survivors of Troy going off to eventually found Rome.
Right.
There's quite a lot of pretext here. But it's also, it's very simple, and it's very much like, oh, okay, that's what we're doing, right? Like, I understand what the goals and what the stakes are. Like,
yeah, it's, again, if we want to use the comparison to The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, like, it's written to be almost a story for the children that would be marketed The Hobbit. But I think that this world, while even being this small rabbit world, feels a little bit bigger and a little bit more mature, like The Lord of the Rings, in a sense.
And kind of, yeah.
Some of the ideas that this novel or this movie has are something that they're more mature. Like, they're very interesting ideas or thoughts or musings about life and struggle and what it means to be a community, in a sense. And you know, for something that's written and geared towards children, all of these bigger ideas really hit home, I think, as you get a little bit older. And I think that this movie, when we get to who this movie is for, I think that there's a really interesting crossroads of where I would recommend this movie maybe in your life. And again, it sounds like, you know, you're coming at this for a first time viewing in your 30s. I'm coming at this for a first time in my 30s. But I thought it was a pretty elevated story. Like, I thought that this was something that was pretty rich, and I was pretty interested in the deeper lore of this. Like, I actually am genuinely interested to read the book after watching this movie.
Yeah, and you know what I'll say? I typically don't care much for world building. I actually don't have much patience for excessive world building. That's kind of why it took me so long to get through The Way of Kings. Actually, let me rephrase. It's why I have not yet to finish The Way of Kings. But this movie really, like, I felt I'm a little in, like, I think I am going to go read the book cover to cover now. Like, it's, you know, obviously the movie can't present the same level of detail that the book can, but like, even at the beginning, in the first 5 minutes, Hazel and Fiverr go grazing, and two members of the Ashua, which are kind of like, I guess you could call them like the warrior class of the rabbits, they instantly steal their food, and they're like, hey, like, we're the Ashua, we go graze over there, right? So right. Like, instantly we're aware, oh, there's like a caste system here, right? There's a hierarchy.
That's the other interesting thing about this text and this film, is that this is a story, again, about rabbits, and it's framed in, you put it really well in the plot, it's framed around prey. It's framed around these rabbits that you would consider to be helpless to all of these predators that would live in their environment. But they also take on all of these humanistic characteristics and ideas and human societal systems, right? And so it's so interesting seeing them framed around an animal that is so vastly different from us, and then how those kind of ideas and structures kind of play out in their world.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, again, I particularly like, you know, the whole movie starts with their essentially creation myth, right? Like,
right.
Basically, their whole conception of the world is that initially all the animals were more or less the same, but then their proto-rabbit ancestors were basically like breeding too quickly to overpopulating the world. So the sun god, Firth, or whatever his name is, he right. told them to stop, and their ancestors wouldn't. So he divided the whole animal kingdom into predators and prey, right? Some
right.
animals got claws, some got fangs, and then basically, but then the blessing he gave to the proto rabbits was basically to make them really, really fast. And there's that yeah. great line where the sun god, it's like, it's really cool. He's basically says, like, all the world will be your enemy, prince with 1,000 enemies. And when they catch you, they will kill you. But first, they must catch you.
Yeah. I'm going to dance around, actually, because we're kind of talking about who this movie's for and if it holds up to modern watch. And, you know, I just kind of want to get ahead a little bit here.
Sure.
And I want to say that the scene that I actually recommend to watch for the one scene to sell this movie, because there's not a movie clips for this online, is just watch that opening prologue. It's on YouTube, the prologue to Watership Down, because it is really fascinating to see that opening prologue of the story of rabbits. Like, it's like, it's such a cool, like, in the beginning kind of
start
to this film. And it feels like it adds a weight to this world immediately. And it really, like, it makes it feel like this world is just so thought out, you know?
Yeah, and it's compelling because it's like, okay, keep in mind, like, say we're at the bottom of the food chain, you know, everybody is out there trying to kill us and eat us. Like, how would you rationalize that to yourself, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, how would you define yourself? Like, you know, in the rabbit world, like, cunning and ingenuity and speed are highly prized attributes to have.
Right. So, characters and people you may know. So, this is a British production. This did come out in 1978. So, I do have a couple of really interesting actors and characters that I do want to bring up in this spot. But just know that for a film that came out in 1978 with a bunch of British actors. You might not know everybody that I'm about to talk to about, and that's okay, but there's some really cool movie connections and actors that took place in here that I want to share. To start off with, we have Hazel, the first brother who ends up developing like a pretty strong leadership role in the group of rabbits who leave the Warren.
Yeah, he's essentially the main character.
Yeah, exactly. And he's played by John Hurt, who is an actor that I know very well from the original Alien movie, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
He is the chest burster character. So,
oh, is he? That's William Hurt?
That is William Hurt. Or wow. John Hurt.
John Hurt.
He also starred in 1984 in The Elephant Man, and he made an appearance in Contact, which we did last year. So,
oh, yeah.
But where modern audiences might actually know John Hurt from is he played Mr. Ollivander in the Harry Potter series.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, very prominent actor, very important to, honestly, just being an alien contact in Harry Potter, pretty important to my film, interest in film.
Did you hear that they were making, this is left field, HBO is now doing a, like, they're doing a multi-season long adaptation of Harry Potter?
Yeah, I'm interested to see how that plays out. Like, it obviously is going to dive a lot deeper into the Harry Potter novels. Like, that's kind of the limitation of a movie, is that those books get longer with each novel. And so for the first movie, you can fit like a 200 or 300 page novel, children's novel, into like an hour and a half, 2 hour movie. But as they get into like the 600 or 700 pages, however long the last Harry Potter book is, it gets harder and harder to fit all of that story and world building into one text, right?
Yeah, I just find it odd that like those movies did not come out that long ago, and now we're getting a full TV series adaptation.
That's the thing. We say that, but the first one did air probably like 20 years ago at this point now, right?
I don't want to be reminded of I don't want to be reminded of my own mortality.
That's just how it works. But anyway, yeah. So it's like we're definitely getting whatever. I'm moving on. The other brother, like you mentioned, is Fiverr, who is the seer of the group. He has those visions, like you said. They're very important. Like, he's the one who's, while he isn't the leader of the group, he's the one driving them forward with these visions and helping them navigate all of these different situations that they find themselves faced in. And spoilers, they find themselves in some pretty wild situations throughout this movie.
They go pretty far down the rabbit hole. you can leave that in if you want. That's all you.
So the next character I want to mention is Big Wig, who is kind of Hazel's right-hand man. They shared the leadership role for, I think, a large part of the movie. He's kind of the big brash rabbit of the group, always willing to, you know, get into the fight, start punching, and ask questions later.
He's the Sonny Corleone of this dynamic.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great comparison.
Yeah.
He's played by Michael Graham Cox, who played Boromir in the Lord of the Rings animated series, which actually, this is the first time that I'm bringing up the Lord of the Rings animated movie.
Oh, yeah.
This shares the same kind of film group that made this movie. So if you've seen the animated film, you're going to feel right at home with the style of this film, the art style and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, like the old-timey, wasn't it like a Ralph Bakshi movie, the Lord of the Rings thing?
I actually don't know.
It might be. I could be wrong.
Anyway, the other character, two other characters I want to mention are Cowslip, who's a rabbit we meet on the journey, who kind of takes them in for a period of time, played by Denholm Elliott, who is Marcus Brody in the Indiana Jones movies. So that's the reason why I'm bringing him up, because Marcus Brody and Indiana Jones are, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time, and he plays a prominent role in that series. And then, like you mentioned at the beginning of this film, Kahar, the Norwegian bird, who steals every scene that he's in, more or less.
Yeah, really. It's truly a sight to behold.
Yeah, it's pretty great. It's a pretty great performance by Zero Mostel, who was one of the co-stars of the film The Producers, which is a Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder film that I need to watch at some point.
Yeah, me too. I'm surprised neither of us have seen that.
Actually, Jason and I are potentially bouncing that around as our next movie for the next episode, so we'll see if we have a connection directly there.
Okay.
The last kind of connection that I actually do want to quickly mention is if you go way back to our first movie draft, I did Sidney Lumet's filmography, and I covered in the middle a film that we haven't talked about since that episode, but the movie The Hill, which stars Sean Connery, which I really, really enjoyed that movie a lot. And this actually has two actors from that film, and that is Roy Kinnear and Harry Andrews, the voice actor playing General Woundwort.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so there's a really cool connection to The Hill, so I highly recommend going back listening to our first movie draft episode, because we had a lot of fun doing that, and it's where I really discovered Sidney Lumet for the first time and got into his filmography pretty hard.
And you have worked him into almost every episode we've done thus far.
That's so true. It's just he's so prominent once you know he exists.
You can't not know that he exists, for sure.
Yeah. So who is this movie for, and does it hold up to a modern watch? And this is where the most interesting part of this episode gets, because this movie is rated G, or it was rated G when it first came out, for general all audiences, no concerns. And as you mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, this is a film that traumatized a generation of children.
You know, it's kind of funny. When I was first watching this movie, I was like, all right, like, how dark could it be? Jesus. And then something happens half an hour in where I'm like, oh my God. And then I'm like, okay, maybe it was just that one part. Then something else happens towards the end where, again, I was like, oh my God. Like, so, yeah.
This is a very violent film. It's portraying the hardships of the life of Rabbit, and it doesn't shy away from any of those hardships.
Have you ever seen, I actually, fun fact, this is not related at all, and I'm just thinking of it now. I had to watch a YouTube video of a rabbit being killed and skinned in the last couple weeks. It was for a scene I was writing in my book, the one that's with my agent right now. So
right.
I watched the whole thing. Like, I watched the rabbit die. I learned how to rip its organs out, how to like rip the fur off, how to cook it and prepare it. The wow. things I do as a writer. And anyways, that video was almost, this movie was only slightly less graphic than that video. I'm being a little hyperbolic, but the point remains. This movie is like, there's a scene towards the end where General Woundwort, like the main villain, basically says, I'll rip all their throats out. And like in any other children's movie, I'd be like, well, that's not going to happen. In this movie, I was like, well, like maybe that will happen.
Yeah, this is like almost like Game of Thrones light in a sense.
Yeah.
You don't know who's going to go and when.
Mm-hmm.
There are some pretty prominent deaths in this film.
Some pretty prominent maiming and injuries.
Near-death experiences. Yeah, it's very intense. And I don't think, and this is something that's funny, a part of the legacy of this film, is that eventually the British board that rated this G, years and decades later, said, okay, you know what? So many people have commented on this. We get it. We made a mistake. This probably should be rated PG.
Yeah, they're like, all right, that's it. No more G rating for you.
And if this was made today, like either it would be toned down even more than it already is, I'm sure, from the novel, or it would have a PG or even a PG-13 rating, debatable.
Well, you know, it's funny. I feel like we're in this golden age of animated movies, right? With like Encanto and like Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, and like those movies in particular tackle some pretty heady themes like generational trauma or panic attacks or even like fearing for your own mortality. But even those movies with some very complex, very adult subject matter, I don't think characters ever get like viscerally ripped apart on screen. So, yeah. So, yeah.
Now, that being said, so on the flip side of this discussion, like, this is an epic in the true sense of the word. It's a nature epic, very compelling story, very well written. It's a fantasy, like you said, and it is written towards children. And I've read a lot of, there's so much discussion back and forth about who this movie really is truly for. And I think that in the age bracket of like 8 to 12 years old, I think you could probably like, maybe if your kid's not super mature and into like scarier movies at 8 years old, you probably wouldn't go there. But I think that if your kid can handle something a little bit more shocking on screen, that the ideas and the concepts and just the provoking nature of this film is, it's so interesting to watch a movie like this. And
yeah,
and some of these concepts, like, it would be like thinking about these ideas as a child for the first time, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I think I saw a video where Guillermo del Toro talks about seeing this movie when he was 13 and how it kind of like, it taught him that animation could be more mature. It could have room for more mature subject matter and all that stuff. And like,
right,
he was the right age where like he was becoming like a young man, like a teenager, and like life is suddenly much more complicated.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's something that's really unique about this, is this film doesn't shy away from the realities of life and struggle, and like the fact that things don't always work out the way that you want them to or expect them to.
No, and sometimes you get ripped apart by a dictator with his bare hands.
However, I'll say, like, as an adult, I actually genuinely enjoyed the story. I thought this was a really, really well-written narrative.
I agree. I enjoyed this a lot more. I did enjoy this quite a bit. Aside from all that, though, there is, this movie is, like, 40 years old now. Wait, it came out in 78, so would that make it 40 or 50?
It's almost 50 years old now. It's getting close to 50.
And there is a certain level of, in this, it doesn't quite have the same budget that like an old Disney movie had. So like, I will say there is a little bit of jankiness you have to adjust to, right? In terms of the voice acting and the animation itself, like the first 10 or 20 minutes, I was kind of gritting my teeth like, oh no. But once you adapt and it's fine, right? But you have to really let yourself. There's a, to borrow an expression from Super Bunny Hop, there's a cringe curve you have to acclimatize to.
I see what you did there with the Bunny Hop reference, though.
Oh, that was completely, that's why I'm a professional. Yeah.
No, but you're 100% right. And that is ultimately in the deep dive discussion, a discussion that I wanted to have about the art style and the voice work and all of that. It does feel very dated in that sense. It's something that, you're right, your brain just has to adjust to. And the prologue is very unique and very different to the rest of the art style of the rest of the film. And so I was drawn in at the prologue, and then I kind of got pulled back out again in
those first
opening scenes. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this. And it was really probably around the point in time, like 30 or so minutes in, where they're invited into that new Warren, is really when I started to get it really heavily invested in this story.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, the first 20 minutes, not counting the prologue, can be a little iffy, but you should stick through it, right?
Yeah, so at the end of the day, I think you and I are on the same page. Does this movie hold up perfectly in 2024? No, but that's more because of the actual film art and production values than it is the story itself. The story is something unique and worth your time.
Yeah, and the fact that the story can still suck you in almost 50 years later, despite that, despite the technical barriers, is pretty impressive.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. Do you have a different scene that you wanted to share as part of the one scene to sell the movie?
I actually completely forgot we were doing that, despite me.
That's okay. There's no movie clips, so I mentioned it earlier about the prologue, and we don't have to do anymore.
I agree, though. The prologue is a good place to start. There's also a YouTube video that I saw that's just called, like, Watership Down Most Violent / Disturbing Moments, and it's 13 minutes long. So, like, if you want to review it before you watch it with your children, maybe there's that.
Yeah, I guess, like, in a sense, that's fine. But on the flip side to that, like, I think context is important to some of that, right? Like, it would be also like watching a Quentin Tarantino movie, but only the deaths or something.
Yeah,
like
it's
that,
like a super cut. All the gunshot or all like the gunshot wounds to the head.
Yeah, like that feels disingenuous to watch something like that and come away from it like, oh, I have a problem with this because it's so violent. Like, you know, like not getting the full context of the violence, I think, is something that's really important.
Yeah, for sure.
So when to watch? I like this for a Sunday evening movie because, you know, it's an animated film. It feels, while it's directed towards kids, I also had a really good time with it as an adult. That's just kind of my night for like family, more family-oriented films. And that kind of feels like something more like this.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say definitely an evening watch for sure.
Yeah, evening too. Like not like late night. Like, you know, you'd start this at like no later than 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. It's only 90 minutes, so if you need something to cheer yourself up afterwards, you've got time.
Yeah. Man, I miss 90-minute movies. I was looking for a 90-minute movie yesterday, and I was having an impossible time finding something.
Yeah, fuck off with all these three-hour-long things, you know?
Yeah, like, I mean, they have their time and their place, but, you know, occasionally I just want to watch, like, a 90-minute Indiana Jones film or something like that.
Yeah, something a little more digestible.
And tight, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, where to watch right now, you can watch this on the Criterion channel. I streamed it on YouTube, just rented it on YouTube.
Oh, you did? There's actually, there's a full uncut free version on YouTube.
Oh, interesting. What was the quality of that like?
It was good. It was actually really good. I think it's been up for a couple of years now, so this is the one time you rented something off YouTube and I didn't.
Nice. Well, what I'll say is, honestly, like, I thought the YouTube rented version actually, and this is maybe something that you can speak to, there was almost like a strobing effect in some scenes, and
oh,
I wasn't
really
sure if, like, the coloration was kind of off. Like, I actually thought there was something almost, like, wrong with the digital upload that YouTube had available for rent. So I don't know if I'd recommend that as, like, the go-to. Like, I think if you have
what?
A different rental
that might
site...
That might just be the movie itself, because I noticed the color doing weird things at different points, too.
Okay, yeah. So I wasn't sure. I wanted to ask you if you noticed that as well, because it was very strange. Yeah, so, okay, it's good to know that you had similar issues recording or watching the film that I did. And, you know, it'd be cool to see, like, a restoration of this, maybe, like, and some improvement to some of the coloring of the film, but at that point, like, you're probably just looking at
a new adaptation
anyway.
And by the way, there have been a couple other adaptations since then, and maybe we can talk about those too.
Yeah, I think we will. But otherwise, I think that's it for the primer conversation, unless you have anything else you want to add.
Nah, I think we about covered as much as we can cover without going down the rabbit hole. I did it again.
Nice.
That's twice in one episode. I promise not to do it in the deep dive.
Sounds good. All right. Well, we'll see you next time. As always, tell your dad.
Tell your dad.